Let me get my... This is a Gloria Jean's coffee token. When I was a kid, they had coffee wooden nickels, and they were promotions. I don't really know where I got this, but I'm trying to remember. There was a time, and I even gave a sermon on it years back when I was young and strong and vibrant, and I would go out and I would train in the spring with mountaineering. I'd put on boots, go to Mount Spokane, and I would just tromp up all and down the mountain. And if you go up there in the spring when the snow's melting off, what you find is all of the leftovers from the ski season that people dropped when they tried to take their gloves off and things fell in the snow. And so this, I think that's probably where this came from, because I had to look. They have Gloria Jean's in Australia. I haven't seen one locally, but it's a coffee token. You can get a free cup of coffee. Now, the word token is used in the sense that it's not real. I mean, it's a real token, but it's not like it's money. I can't go buy a sandwich with it. And so they have tokens that became part of a cultural term. To be tokenism, or to be token, is to do something symbolically, not truly do it in its full intent and way. You make a token effort. You're not really making an effort, but you want it to look like you're making an effort, so you make some effort. And that way, at least for the show, for the appearance, I made an effort. But it's called a token effort. You can get a token reward, which means it's not really a reward, but it's kind of like, well, we wanted to give you a reward, and just so you know that we're thinking about you. And so it came to be culturally part of that meaning. When Megan was in college, she served as a waitress for a short time. Didn't work out too well for her, but she did it. It was a good experience in that sense. But she said you could tell when somebody was not going to give you a tip or not much of a tip. And they would start to praise you. And she said they came to call them verbal tips, kind of a token tip. Oh, wow, what a wonderful waitress you are. This is wonderful service, and you're the best we've ever seen. And she said when they start to pour on the praise, what you knew was that you weren't going to get a tip. They were trying to give you something that didn't cost them anything, and they called those verbal tips. Again, a token. Tokenism, in terms of religion, is the pretense of worship. It's putting in the appearance. Well, I showed up. Well, I'm here. Well, I actually got on my knees. It's not the real thing. It's not the full thing. It's kind of a token. Tokenism in religion is kind of form without the full substance. It's not giving God our best. God is a great king, a great God. He is a powerful, supreme entity. And what he wants from us is our best. He doesn't want the token. He doesn't want the symbol. He doesn't want what's left. He wants what's first. And throughout the Bible, he gives example after example of how we should appear before him and how we should think of him. We live in a society that's supposed to be non-judgmental, very accepting, tolerance. And then that gets transferred in religion, I believe, to God in man's perspective, those that believe in God, at least to some degree, to where God's kind of like the what I would describe as the man Jesus. Now, that's a real biblical term. But the man Jesus is the Christ that healed and broke the bread and multiplied the fishes and fed people and cared for them and showed empathy for them. It's not the Jesus coming on the day of the Lord to destroy Babylon and the beast. There's a kind of the sensitive part of that. It's a true statement, but it's not the whole picture. It's the God is merciful without all of the God is just, which is part of that same package. So I think sometimes there is a tendency in religion to become a token. Take the soft part, take the easy part, take the pleasant part, and say, well, that's what this is. You're here to have fun. You should have fun when you go to church. You should be able to be satisfied, emotionally lifted and pleasant, pleased by what services would provide. When people call now, sometimes, wanting to come to services, literally, What they're asking many times is, do you agree with me? They're not asking to come and be taught. Literally, they're asking, do you agree with me? I already know what I believe, and I want to see if what you have is right for us. Do you have a ministry for young adults? Do you have a ministry for young married? Do you have child care? Do you have... They begin to go through some of the things. They begin to say, well, how far is this away? You know, I don't want to have to drive, you know, over a regional area. But it's a focus that is the opposite of what God gave us. What God gave us is that we are to give to Him. Now, He blesses us, but that is His choice. Christianity, though, is a sacrifice. It's not a collection agency. It's not where you gather up the gifts and the benefits and the opportunity and the satisfaction and the pleasure and what it is we want. It's where we submit ourselves fully and totally in God, in His service. Look at Exodus chapter 3. This life is just not... You know, I know this sounds so strange to say. This life is not about being happy. I'd like to say it was. That's not the bottom line. And those who just have to be happy, and they have to be happy now, are not going to see this the way it plays. Exodus 3, Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. He led the flock to the back of the desert. He came to Horeb, the mountain of God. The angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of the bush. He looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire. The bush was not consumed. Then Moses said, I will turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush does not burn. It's obviously not in Washington State right now. So when the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush, and says, Moses, Moses. And he says, here I am. And notice now, God says, okay, here's how I want you to think of this, Moses. Verse 5, do not draw near this place. Take the sandals off your feet. The place where you stand is holy ground. Now think of that. Were Moses' feet clean and his sandals dirty? I don't think so. I'd say, when I take my sandals off, my feet are worse than the sandals. If I walk in my bare feet, things, you know, stick to my feet more than they stick to my shoes. It's not a physical thing. It is a spiritual focus. He was saying, this is holy ground, and I want you to think of it in a special way. And I want you to approach me carefully and respectfully, just exactly the way I say. Whatever that isn't the issue so much as what it is, what God says. So, what God wants is us to look to Him. What do you want, Lord? What can I do? What God chooses to return to us and how He chooses to work with us is up to Him, because He has perfect knowledge and ability to make that choice. But from our perspective, we are supposed to give to God our best. Our best time, our best resource, our best effort. We're supposed to give to Him that which goes first. You don't give God what's left over after you have exhausted all the resource. You give to God first in honor for having given what we've received. Exodus 28, we see it in a little different framework. Exodus 28. These are garments for Aaron and how God wanted him to come and appear before Him at the temple. Tabernacle then later became a temple. Exodus 28 says, take Aaron your brother and his sons with him from among the children of Israel, that he may minister to me as priest. Aaron and Aaron's sons, Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. And make them holy garments. Holy garments. These are garments that are dedicated to God. You come and put these on before you appear. For Aaron and your brother, it says, for glory and for beauty. Make them of the finest material in the best possible way to give glory to God, but to show that you are holy as God is holy. and that's what they were to portray. Speak to all who are gifted artisans, whom I filled with the spirit of wisdom, that they may make Aaron's garments to sanctify him, that he may minister to me as priest. So the stitching and the embroidery and the design and the color and the fit was supposed to be of the finest possible quality. They were going to appear before God. These are the garments with which they shall make. It says a breastplate, an ephod, a robe, a skillfully woven tunic, a turban, and a sash. And they shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother and his sons, that he may minister to me as a priest. Now, the rest of the chapter goes on and describes in intimate detail some of the elements that would be part of the breastplate and then the priestly garments and the sash and how they were to be designed. Verse 31. You shall make the robe of the ephod all of blue. What if you like and preferred mauve? What if that's what you really liked instead of actual blue? Well, it will cost you your life, because that's not what God said to do. Make the robe of all blue. There shall be an opening for the head in the middle of it. It'll have a woven binding all around its opening, like the opening in a coat of mail, so that it does not tear. Upon its hem you shall make pomegranates of blue and purple and scarlet yarn all around its hem, bells of gold between them all around, a golden bell and a pomegranate, a golden bell and a pomegranate upon the hem all around, just showing the rotation of the pattern. And it shall be upon Aaron when he ministers, and its sound will be heard when he goes into the holy place before the Lord, and when he comes out, that he may not die. This wasn't an optional activity, and you didn't go and say, well, I'd like to use a little creative artistry and make some adjustments to this. God says, you do what I give you to do, that you may not die. Now, that goes on, and it includes, in verse 41, further hats and different parts of the turban, as it said, and the breastplates and the things that they would put on. And you did it all the way God said. Verse 41. Put them on Aaron your brother and on his sons with him. You shall anoint them, consecrate them, sanctify them, that they may minister to me as priests. And you shall make for them linen trousers to cover their nakedness. They shall reach from the waist to the thighs. They'll be on Aaron and on his sons when they come into the tabernacle of meeting, when they come near the altar to minister in the holy place, that they do not incur iniquity and die. So God was very specific that we were to come before God the way he says, that it's supposed to be in a proper way, in a respectful way, in a godly fear. And that doesn't mean God is waiting for us to just cower, but he is a great God. And this is not a, we'll meet you in the middle. This is, we're going to do just exactly what God says. Now, if you take that in the New Testament, a little bit different description in 1 Corinthians 6, but it talks about the fact that the church is the temple of God, and God is going to be in us. And just as Aaron was to go before God for glory and beauty, then our character and our focus should be glory and beauty to God. It should be the same. 1 Corinthians 6, verse number 12, Paul says here, he says, all things are lawful for me, but all things are not helpful. All things are lawful, but I'll not be brought under the power of any. And he goes on to verse 15, do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? So I then shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a harlot? Certainly not. This is simply the spiritual application of the description of the priesthood and the way they would come before God in the Old Testament. God is in us in the New Testament. Do you not know that he who is joined to a harlot is one body with her? For the two, he says, shall become one flesh. But he who is joined to the Lord is one spirit with him. Flee sexual immorality. Every sin that a man does is outside the body, but he who commits sexual immorality sins against his own body. Or do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have from God, and you are not your own? Therefore you're bought at a price. Therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit. The priesthood was to dress for glory and for beauty, and we are to have in our own mind and character glorification before God based on who we are and what we do, how we think, what we say. We're supposed to give ourselves to God, and we're supposed to make that a purification. We're purified by the blood of Christ, but our response to that must be then to continue. You know, the days of unleavened bread, you don't go into the days of unleavened bread to put out sin in that sense. Sin, you're unleavened when you enter the days of unleavened bread. The days of unleavened bread are to take the bread of Christ, the bread of life, to take it in, to remain unleavened, as compared to become unleavened. You're unleavened as you walk in the door, and then we're to remain that. Christ cleanses us from sin. We are to continue in that state. And when we do sin, we repent. But we give God first our allegiance, our time and energy, our focus, our service goes to God first. We give to God our best. Now, I've asked a couple of people coming into this sermon, and I said, where in the Bible do you think of when it talks about giving God the best, where would you go? And they immediately say Malachi, book of Malachi. And it's a passage that I've read at least in part recently, but it is so specific, I do want to go back in Malachi chapter 1, because God portrays the need for us to recognize that what we give him goes to him first. Before all our other obligations, before our other duties, before our other debts, we give to God first. You do not cover your needs and then pay God. You pay God, and he will bless us, and our needs will be covered. It doesn't always work out on paper. It does work out in reality. Malachi 1, verse number 6, a son honors his father, a servant his master. If I am then the father, where is my honor? If I am the master, where is my reverence? Says the Lord of hosts. To you priests who despise my name, yet you say, in what way have we despised your name? You offer defiled food on my altar. You give God the leftovers, the defect, the spoilage, the things that are no longer necessary, and you give that to God. God says, that's not the way this is going to be. But you say, in what way have we defiled you? By saying, the table of the Lord is contemptible. When you offer the blind as a sacrifice, is it not evil? Becomes a token of a true sacrifice. You can say, well, look, I made sacrifice. I did it. I did what I was supposed to do. God says, no, you haven't. When you offer the lame and the sick, is it not evil? Offer it then to your governor. Would he be pleased with you? Would he accept you favorably? Says the Lord of hosts. God says it's better to shut the doors on the temple than to walk in with something that is lame or blind or sick. Better to just shut the door and don't even show up. Don't go to the altar with something that is defective. God says, you will bring me the best. Verse 12. You profane it, God's name, in that you say, and are calling of sacrificial service. You profane it in that you say the table of the Lord is defiled, its food is contemptible. You know, it is not a blessing to be a servant of God in this life, saying that it's a price to pay. Our children are going to grow up and they're going to miss out on sports and activities and they won't have a chance to get their education and fulfill their purpose. That is so upside down. The power of the universe calls us into his service. That is a blessing, that is an opportunity, that is an opening, that is not a closure. And those who look at it as somehow a burden or keeping the Sabbath as a weariness or paying God his tithe is somehow too much, We don't have it. We're not ready. We have this. We have something else. Keeping this commitment, our covenants. You say, verse 13, what a weariness. And you sneer at it, says the Lord of hosts. And you bring the stolen, the lame, and the sick. Thus you bring an offering. Should I accept this from your hand? God says, I am a great king. My name shall be feared among the nations. So God just says, you know, be careful how you come before me. In humility, take the shoes off your feet. I'm not speaking literally now. But recognize that we go before a holy, supreme, all-powerful being who wants our best interest. But he wants us to understand that he comes first. And the Bible is filled with those analogies showing the importance of the first fruits, the importance of the harvest of first fruit, the importance of the firstborn among many brethren, and the firstborn that would then follow, and how that is how God portrays the best, the finest, his greater part of that creation. When I was first attending the church, I would come up to a holy day, and you had to give an offering. And basically, I would open my checkbook to see what there was, or I'd open my wallet to see what cash I had, and I'd decide how much I could afford to give. And what I found was, when I did it that way, honestly, I gave very little. And it came to my mind, ultimately, as I learned and understood better, that what I was doing is I was just giving God what was left. Meet the needs, pay the bills, live my life, and then when it's all over, what do I got here that remains? I'll give you some of that. Here's some of the leftovers. Can you imagine going to the fridge, taking out the food from yesterday, taking a little bit and making sacrifice to God? He says it's not done that way. When I came to understand that, in time I began to realize that in preparation to give God what is first, that I would have to set it aside as a first. As the increase then was realized, I began to set aside a portion each time in preparation for the offering. And what was amazing, my guess is my offering probably increased by times 10. It just did. And, you know, I couldn't go back and measure it, but my guess is my blessings increased accordingly. There was a member sitting right here in this congregation years ago that got down to where he had a dollar that he thought he could sacrifice very, very desperately in trouble financially. And he came to a holy day and he put his dollar into the offering. On that same Sabbath, someone had given me a gift that I had no idea what was in it. And it had his name, the person had know of his struggle, and they had made a gift. It had to have been a fairly sizable gift. And I had no knowledge. I simply handed it to him. He put his dollar in the plate that day. And then he sent me a note later. He said, because of the generosity of the gift, I put my dollar. He says, I prayed to God, increase this dollar 100-fold. Now, what he meant by that was that God would take his lonely dollar and use it for his glory in some way that was increase. What God did is the next offering was 100-fold from his dollar based on his own increase. God says, all right, I'll make it 100-fold. The next offering was 100-fold that came in as a result. It was an amazing comment that he made in a note that he sent me. God knows what he's doing. Is that a guarantee? Wow, let's just invest in God. I'll give you one. You make me win the lottery. That's not what this is. We give God his first, and we give him our best because of who he is, and because of what he has done, and because of what he has taught us. Psalm 96, verse number 7. Pretty simple statement, but it just says, give to the Lord O kindreds of the peoples, give to the Lord glory and strength. Give to the Lord the glory due his name. Bring an offering. Come into his courts. Worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness. Tremble before him, all the earth. Give to the Lord the glory due his name. Worship him in the beauty of holiness. That's very closely tied into the way the garments were for the priesthood, the way the church is before God in their own manner. God is due more than we would ever be able to return to him. I want to read you a story of Gehazi. I don't think I've ever actually used it as an illustration. And it's a little bit of a story flow, so as I read it, I need to be able to lay it out. You'll recognize the story, but it's in 2 Kings chapter 4 was where it starts. I want to show you that Gehazi had the opportunity to serve God at the very highest level. He saw some of the greatest miracles that anyone could have ever seen, and yet he began to want something for himself as compared to what his service would be in his gift and sacrifice to God. He began to say, you know, what's in it now for me? If you ever get to the point to where you look at God or the church or your sacrifices, what am I going to get now? What do I get back? What's this? What's in this for me? You begin to canker a bit. You begin to compromise and risk your own self. 2 Kings 4 says, a certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets cried out to Elisha, saying, your servant, my husband, is dead. You know that your servant feared the Lord. Creditors coming to take my two sons to be his slaves. And Elisha said to her, what shall I do for you? Tell me, what do you have in the house? And she said, your maidservant has nothing in the house but a jar of oil. He said, well, go, borrow vessels from everywhere, from all your neighbors. Empty vessels, do not gather just a few. When you've come in, you should shut the door behind you and your sons, pour into it all those vessels, set aside the full ones. It wasn't for show where people could watch her do this. This wasn't going to exalt her in any way. It was to be privately done. She went from him and shut the door behind her and her sons, brought the vessels to her. She poured it out. It came to pass when the vessels were full that she said to her son, bring me another vessel. And he said to her, there is not another vessel. And then the oil ceased. Then she came and told the man of God. She said, go sell the oil, pay your debt. You and your sons live on the rest. Now, that was a tremendous miracle, and those that were with Elisha closely and intimately knew of these things. So now you have the story that continues, verse number 8, where an even more dramatic miracle now takes place. It says, now it happened one day that Elisha went to Shunem, and there was a notable woman, and she constrained him to eat some food. So it was as often as he passed by that he turned in there to eat some food. She said to her husband, look now, I know that this is a holy man of God who passes by us regularly. Please, let's make a small upper room on the wall, put up a bed for him there, a table and a chair, a lampstand, and it will be whenever he comes to us, he can turn in there. And it happened one day that he came there and he turned into the upper room and lay down. Then he said to Gehazi, his servant. Now, Gehazi was kind of like, I can't say exactly, but let's just say he's the one primarily listed assisting Elisha. Elisha was the one primarily listed as assisting Elijah. This is an opportunity of an individual to serve at a very, very high level and to be used of God in a very mighty way. But he said to Gehazi, his servant, call the Shunammite woman. When he called her, she stood before him, and he said, say now to her, look, you have been concerned for us with all this care. What can I do for you? Do you want me to speak on your behalf to the king or to the commander of the army? She answered, I dwell among my own people. I have my needs. I am here with my own. He said, well, then what is to be done for her? And Gehazi answered, actually, she has no son, and her husband is old. He said, call her. When he'd called her, she stood in the doorway, and then he said, about this time next year, you shall embrace a son. And she said, no, my lord, man of God, do not lie to your maidservant. She's just saying, that's not possible. That's not really truly going to happen. And but the woman conceived, bore a son when the appointed time had come, of which Elisha had told her. Verse 18. The child grew. Now it happened one day when he went out to his father to the reapers. He said to his father, "My head, my head." And he said to his servant, "Carry him to his mother." It doesn't say if it was an injury. It doesn't say if it was an aneurysm. It doesn't say what happened, but there was a serious disability here that took place. When he had taken him and brought him to his mother, he sat on her knees until noon and then died. She went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God, shut the door upon him, and went out. She called her husband and said, "Please, send me one of the young men and one of the donkeys that I may run to the man of God and come back." And he said, "Why are you going to him today? It's neither the new moon nor the Sabbath." She said, "It is well." She saddled a donkey. I can't exactly explain why this thing was done the way it was done. I don't know the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey used to say. It's not in the account. But she appears to be committed to simply doing this, believing that it will be sufficient if she will simply go to Elisha and God will heal. She saddled a donkey, said to her servant, "Drive and go forward. Do not slacken the pace for me unless I tell you." She departed, went to the man of God at Mount Carmel. So it was when the man of God saw her afar off that he said to his servant Gehazi, "Look, there's the Shunammite woman. Please run now to meet her. Say to her, 'Is it well with you? Is it well with your husband? Is it well with your child?'" She answered, "It is well. It's going to be all right," possibly is what she intended. When she came to the man of God at the hill, she caught him by the feet. But Gehazi came near to push her away. You know, she was out of order in the social context in his eyes. But the man of God said, "Let her alone. Her soul is in deep distress, and the Lord has hidden it from me and has not told me." She said, "Did I ask a son of my Lord? Did I not say, 'Don't deceive me'?" Then he said to Gehazi, "Get yourself ready, take my staff in your hand, and be on your way. If you meet anyone, do not greet him. If anyone greets you, do not answer him, but lay my staff on the face of the child." And the mother of the child said, "As the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, I will not leave you." He arose, and he followed her. Now Gehazi went on ahead of them and laid the staff on the face of the child, but there was neither voice nor hearing. Therefore he went back to meet him and told him, saying, "The child has not awakened." Then Elisha came into the house. There was the child lying dead on his bed. He went in, therefore, shut the door behind the two of them and prayed to the Lord. He went up and laid on the child, put his mouth on his mouth, his eyes on his eyes, hands on his hands, stretched himself out on the child, and the flesh of the child became warm. He returned and walked back and forth in the house and went up again and stretched himself out on him. The child sneezed 7 times, and the child opened his eyes. He called Gehazi, and he said, "Call the Shunammite woman." Gehazi sees all of this. He's experienced all of this. He's watched it all take place. And he called her, and she came up to him, and he said, "Pick up your son." So she went in, fell at his feet, bowed to the ground, picked up her son, and went out. Now, the reason I went through that story and read the whole part is because what you go through now is a series of tremendous miracles that take place. You have Elisha purifying a pot of stew that was poisonous. You have Elisha feeding 100 men with a very small amount. And then you have Naaman, who is the commander, verse 1 of chapter 5, the commander of the army of the king of Syria, who's a leper, who then comes to be healed. And he's healed by following the instructions he was given. And Elisha wanted nothing in return. He was not merchandising God's people or those who came to God beseeching him for some request. He was going to allow God to give to him as he chose, as compared to him beginning to take advantage of his position. This life is not about what we get from God. It's about what we give to God. Him, God has everything. He needs nothing. But in terms of our own perspective, Let God give you his blessing. Do your part faithfully, but trust God to fulfill his purpose. So all of this comes through. Naaman's leprosy is healed, and then Gehazi then wants something in return. He wants, what are you going to do? You didn't do anything for me. I've been serving all this time. What have I got? This isn't enough. I struggle. I'm up all night. I'm with you in the day. What have I got? Has it been worth it? Was it worth it to serve God in this church for 50 years? Was it worth it? Is it worth it when you get sick to serve God? Is it worth it when there's financial struggles to serve God? Is it worth it if you lose a child to serve God? Well, that's what our mind will ask and question sometimes. Has it been worth it? It has certainly been worth it. 2 Kings 5 and verse 20, after Naaman leaves, Elisha refuses any gift for simply serving God in that way. It says, Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, look, my master has spared Naaman this Syrian while not receiving from his hands what he brought. He brought gifts. He would have happily given them. Why not just take it? Why not just have it and have the benefit of it? But as the Lord lives, I'll run after him and I will take something from him. So Gehazi pursued Naaman. When Naaman saw him running after him, he got down from his chariot to meet him and said, is all well? He said, all is well. My master has sent me, saying, indeed, just now two young men of the sons of the prophets have come to me from the mountains of Ephraim. Please give them a talent of silver and two changes of garments. So Naaman said, please take two talents, one for each of the sons of the prophets, apparently. He urged him and bound two talents of silver in two bags with two changes of garments, handed them over to two of his servants, and they carried on ahead of him. And when he came to the citadel, he took them from their hand, stored them away in the house, and he let the men go, and they departed. Now when he went in and stood before his master, and Elisha said to him, where did you go, Gehazi? And he said, well, your servant didn't go anywhere. He said to him, did not my heart go with you when the man turned back from his chariot to meet you? Is it time to receive money and to receive clothing, olive groves and vineyards, sheep and oxen, male and female servants? Is this life about building our business, increasing our riches, having our dreams, having the retirement property or the vacation resort or making the special trip? Is our life about what we're going to get it? Is that what makes this life worth it? Or is it worth simply serving God and giving the glory to him? The blessings will come. Our diligent effort will show increase. But when we start to say, has it been worth it to serve God all these years? We need to understand what that means. Did not my heart go with you? Verse 26. Is it time to receive money and clothing and olive groves and vineyards, sheep and oxen, male and female servants? Therefore the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and your descendants. Can you imagine making a decision that punishes your descendants? We do it every day in some way at some times. If we make decisions that dishonor God, it takes away literally from, and sometimes, our own descendants. Do you think if somebody doesn't destroy themselves in some way through abuse, that doesn't affect those who follow? It absolutely does. But in this case, it was very specific. He went out from his presence leprous and white as snow. Now, I read what I could about Gehazi, and there's a lot of speculation because the account is not now complete. You know, did that follow through? Did that continue? Did Gehazi go off and mourn and be unhappy for the rest of his life? Well, it's an interesting thing. There is one more account if you go to 2 Kings chapter 8. There's another account where Gehazi is mentioned. Gehazi apparently actually continued, and I would assume in faithfulness. And what happened then as a result is off the record. I can only say in terms of what we would think, we can now maybe hope for the best. But it just says 2 Kings 8. Elisha spoke to the woman whose son he had restored to life, saying, "Arise and go." She had left the land and was coming back. She was going to leave the land and come back and ask for her land back. There was trouble in the land. "Rise and go, you and your household, sojourn wherever you can sojourn, for the Lord has called for a famine, and furthermore, it will come upon the land for 7 years." So this is an additional blessing where Elisha literally goes and sends her away to avoid the trouble to come. "The woman arose and did according to the saying of the man of God, went with her household and sojourned in the land of the Philistines 7 years. Came to pass at the end of 7 years that the woman returned from the land of the Philistines, and she went to make an appeal to the king for her house and her land." She had walked away, and it had been absorbed into whoever had taken it over and began to use it in her place. "The king talked with Gehazi, the servant of the man of God." Gehazi is still in Elisha's service 7 years down the road. He's still serving what would appear to be faithfully. And again, maybe God turned and blessed him again. It just doesn't say, but he's here. "The servant of the man of God saying, 'Tell me, please, all the great things Elisha has done.'" So Gehazi now goes back and begins to talk of the miraculous things that God did through Elisha. "It happened as he was telling the king how he had restored the dead to life, that there was a woman whose son he had restored to life, appealing to the king for her house and for her land. And Gehazi said, 'My lord, O king, this is the woman, and this is her son whom Elisha restored to life.' When the king asked the woman, she told him, and the king appointed a certain officer for her, saying, 'Restore all that was hers, all the proceeds of the field, from the day that she left the land until now.'" It's an interesting story because Gehazi had the opportunity to do it right the first time. You know, measure twice, cut once. We brought a carving home on our last trip. Michelle says, "Don't ever bring another carving. You have nowhere to put your carvings. There's always another place." I brought home. And I wanted him in the kitchen. So if you come see us, you come to the kitchen. We call him Ralph, our deacon in Benin City. His name is Ralph. I bought this in Benin City, so we named him after our deacon. Our deacon now sits at dinner with us in the corner. Look, it's life-size bus. But anyway, I went down to buy a piece of wood to buy a shelf, and I had to pick out a piece that had wide enough, and the guy looked at it. I said, "You can cut this?" He said, "Yeah, I can cut this." And I said, "There was white down the sides. Can you cut the white off and make it clean?" He said, "Yeah, I can do that." So he did that. He measured it out, and he ran that saw, and he held it up. He'd cut it too short. You know, in this life, let's be respectful of what God gives us. Don't take a shortcut. Don't be in a rush. Don't hold back. Lay out God in your faith what he deserves. Give it to him first. Don't destroy yourself. That's not what God's asking. He's asking to be honored and respected. Take the time to think about it. Take the time to prepare. Take the time to present yourself before God in an honorable way. Gehazi had that opportunity. And he began to say, "What's in it for me? You know, this hasn't been worth it. The price has been too high. I need some return." And it cost him dearly. My intent and hope in reading this account would be that in learning that and in repenting and being restored, he continued as servant to Elisha, that maybe God restored him. God can withdraw, take back the threat, take back the damage, take away his curse and restore a blessing. There's no point in our life where we cannot truly look to God and say, "Look, I submit myself to you in your mercy." We need to give God his first and our best. Deuteronomy 15 goes back in this case then to an example in reference to why God takes his first. And there's various examples of that. And the point is because we're first. And we're his. And it portrays what he's doing through the church, through us. Deuteronomy 15, verse number 19. all the firstborn males that come from your herd and your flock, you shall sanctify to the Lord your God. You know what he's saying? You give me the first one, and then you can have the next one. And what happens if you say, I'm not ready, let's do this. I'll wait until I have a spare, and then it's yours. He says, sanctify the firstborn to God. You shall do no work with the firstborn of your herd, nor shear the firstborn of your flock. Well, let me get the wool off, and then you can have the carcass. That's not what he says. You and your household, he's actually going to turn, it's taken to the feast and included in your offering at the feast, which you would then eat of it yourself in this case. You and your household shall eat of it before the Lord your God year by year in the place which the Lord chooses. But if there is any defect in it, if it's lame or blind or has any serious defect, you shall not sacrifice it to the Lord your God. You can eat it at home. You can use it for yourself. I'll replace it with the next one. But he says, whatever you give me must be pure. Now, if you go back to Cain and Abel, and you try to go through and assess what happened here, we know that Abel was faithful, righteous Abel, and that Cain was unfaithful. But in their offering, you can say, well, did God want an animal compared to a grain? I don't know that I can say that. I can assume that, but I do say this. Abel offered the first fruits, the firstborn. It's in the account. There was an honor of God giving his first and his best. I think we can assume that Cain gave him what was left over or what he didn't need, just simply in the context of the attitude that was there. And it did not go well. And Cain got angry and became accountable for what he had done. Look at Numbers 3. In God choosing Israel as his firstborn people, and then choosing the Levites as his firstborn tribe for his service. Numbers 3, verse number 5. Going first is harder. If you're climbing a mountain that has never been climbed and you go first, you don't actually know for sure if it can be done. Once you've climbed it, everyone else knows it's possible. But the first one out does not know that for sure. And so those who go first take the greatest risks, generally speaking. They have the hardest efforts. And it requires something extra, quite frankly, to be the one that does something that's never been done. The resurrection and the first resurrection has never been done. Christ went first, showed us it could be done, and it would be, and that we would follow. That was very, very important. But it's very symbolic also. Numbers 3 and verse number 5 says, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, bring the tribe of Levi near, present them before Aaron the priest, that they may serve him. They will attend to his needs and the needs of the whole congregation before the tabernacle of meeting to do the work of the tabernacle. They shall attend to all the furnishings of the tabernacle of meeting, to the needs of the children of Israel to do the work of the tabernacle. You shall give the Levites to Aaron and his sons. They are given entirely to him from among the children of Israel. So you shall appoint Aaron and his sons, and they'll attend to the priesthood. But the outsider who comes near shall be put to death. You do not choose to approach God of your own pleasure. It is according to as God instructs. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, now behold, I myself have taken the Levites from among the children of Israel, instead of every firstborn who opens the womb among the children of Israel. Therefore the Levites shall be mine. Because all the firstborn are mine. On the day that I struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, I sanctified to myself all the firstborn of Israel. Both man and beast, they shall be mine. I am the Lord. Because it's symbolic of salvation, it's symbolic of what God is doing through Jesus Christ, and ultimately the church included. Proverbs 3 is a similar analogy in the sense of using the first fruit as compared to the firstborn. But again, man and beast, firstborn, fruit then becomes the harvest. The church is also a harvest, and so both analogies are used. Proverbs 3 and verse number 9. It says, honor the Lord with your possessions and with the first fruits of all your increase. So your barns will be filled with plenty and your vats will overflow with new wine. We have a grapevine, a single vine that has been planted. It was a gift from a member of years ago, and it has borne harvested fruit, and there is heavy fruit on that vine. And we have sampled a few little bits of the grapes to wait until we see that they're ripe. And what we will do, only because of what we're striving to apply in principle as compared to a specific continuing command, we will take the first bunches off of that and we will give them to one of the ministry. I'm not asking for your produce, please. We have zucchini already. But simply to try to respect God's wish, many times in the past when people have offered us their first fruits, we have offered simply give them to a member or shared, someone who has more need. So that's not my point. But literally, we'll take the first bundles off of that and we'll give them to someone as our first fruit of the increase, and then we will take the harvest that remains. I'm not saying that's our command today. The temple, the sacrificial system, the priesthood, the nation of Israel is no longer in existence. I'm just saying, in the effort to try to understand God's principle, that's what we will do. Think about your lives. Think about what it is that you have that comes first and how you can either honor God, give it to God, or use it in His service. That's what God would instruct. It's symbolic of what God is doing with us as well. James chapter 1, verse 17, again, showing our relationship to this. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning. Of His own will He brought us forth by the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruits of His creatures, a type of the early part of the harvest, of the most special part of the harvest, of the part of the harvest that is special to God. 1 Corinthians 15, the resurrection chapter, uses that also as He was the first of the first fruits that went before us. He showed it could be done. He showed that it would be done. You know, God isn't interested in tokens. He's not interested in token of our appreciation, a token of our time, a token effort. He's not interested because He has given us everything we have. And He wants us to recognize that He, in His majesty, in His power, has given to us. And He wants us to then turn and put Him first in recognition and in return, but not as payment, as thanks. In honor, because He has the right in creating all things. Colossians 1, then, and verse number 9. Paul writing to the Colossian church, says, for this reason we also, since the day we heard it, do not cease to pray for you, to ask that you may be filled with the knowledge of His will in all wisdom and spiritual understanding, that you may walk a walk worthy of the Lord, fully pleasing to Him, being fruitful in every good work, and increasing in the knowledge of God. You want to know how to be fruitful? You give the first part of the harvest to God. And then He increases our fruitfulness and blesses us in return. It's not a gimmick. It is our rightful, necessary service. Strengthened with all might, according to His glorious power, for all patience and long-suffering with joy, giving thanks to the Father who has qualified us to be partakers of the inheritance of the saints in the light, He has delivered us from the power of darkness, translated us into the kingdom of the Son of his love, in whom we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of sins. He's the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. By him all things were created that are in heaven and that are on the earth, visible and invisible, thrones or dominions, principalities or powers. All things were created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things consist. The head of the body, the church, who is in the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in all things he will have, he may have preeminence. God exalted Christ, and they are going to exalt us to join them. And we have proof and knowledge that it will take place because he went and there and did it. God raised him from the dead. So when we think about giving God our best, it's actually a lesson about the first fruits, about the firstborn, about that which is honoring God and recognizing his supremacy and his power and his glory, and it's our way of showing thanks in an appropriate and proper way. Remember, always give God your best and give it to him first. It's his rightful return. And he has blessed us in so many ways. It is our rightful service.